Psalm 35 actually is one example, one means by which God works in us to make us like Christ. That is through the afflictions of wicked men, through troubles in our relationships. And Psalm 35 is a challenging passage. There's definitely some issues that I'm going to try to cover a little bit, but only cover very briefly for time's sake. But there's some things in here that certainly merit some serious thought and prayer and study. And yet at the same time, if the challenges are there, there's some very clear principles that we certainly should be applying. So Psalm 35 is where we're going to be looking this morning, and I'm going to read the first half of it, but down to verse 15. He says, "Plead my cause, O Lord, with them that strive with me. Fight against them that fight against me. Take hold of shield and buckler and stand up for mine help. Draw out also the spear and stop the way against them that persecute me. Say unto my soul, I am thy salvation. Let them be confounded and put to shame that seek after my soul. Let them be turned back and brought to confusion that devise my hurt. Let them be as chaff before the wind, and let the angel of the Lord chase them. Let their way be dark and slippery, and let the angel of the Lord persecute them. For without cause have they hid from me their net in a pit, which without cause they have digged for my soul. Let destruction come upon him at unawares, and let his net that he hath hid catch himself. Into that very destruction let him fall, and my soul shall be joyful in the Lord. It shall rejoice in his salvation. All my bones shall say, Lord, who is like unto thee, which deliverest the poor from him that is too strong for him. For him, yea, the poor and the needy from him that spoileth him. False witnesses did rise up. They laid to my charge things that I knew not. They rewarded me evil for good to the spoiling of my soul. But as for me, when they were sick, my clothing was sackcloth. I humbled my soul with fasting, and my prayer returned into mine own bosom. I behaved myself as though he had been my friend or brother. I bowed down heavily as one that mourneth for his mother. But in mine adversity they rejoiced and gathered themselves together. Yea, the abjects gathered themselves together against me, and I knew it not. They did tear me and ceased not." 3 years ago, a young man entered a prayer meeting at a church in Charleston. After the Bible study, when the church members began to pray, he pulled out a gun, shot, and killed 9 people. Later, at the murderer's court appearance, the relatives of those that were killed spoke. And let me quote the Washington Post here. It says, "One by one, those who chose to speak did not turn to anger. Instead, while he remained impassive, they offered him forgiveness and said they were praying for his soul, even as they described the pain, their losses." Some of you, many of you maybe remember that shooting, and I remembered it because of the response, the very notable, noteworthy response of the church members. Though many of us have never been threatened by a thug with a gun, many of us have never seen family members or close friends shot down, I would guess that a large number of you have suffered mistreatment from others at some point in your life. It may have been severe abuse. It may have been the wicked boss or malicious co-workers. It may have been mockery or hatred from those around you. But various forms of mistreatment, of evil treatment, has come against us. And how do you as a Christian respond when people do wicked things to you? Of course, in the world at large, revenge is a very popular response. They said this about me or said this to me, therefore I will do this back. You know, lawsuits, another option. They caused me to suffer, therefore I will make them pay. In some cases, it is advisable or necessary even to charge the person with the crime. And as Christians who think through this, and I trust you have and will really think through, how do we deal with this? We wrestle through the right responses to the various wicked people around us, particularly when they do evil things against us. Should I sue, or was that unchristian? Should I file charges here, or does that show a lack of forgiveness? Should I tell that person they cannot come into my home anymore, or is that unkind? Should I try to figure out a way to avoid being around them? What do I do? How do I respond when someone seeks to do harm to me? And there are a number of Christians, and sometimes an influential number of Christians, who believe that the model of Christ is always a model of passivity or pacification. That Jesus is nonviolence. In fact, I just happened to read this last week, and an influential scholar, influential author said this again. He argued, his argument was that Jesus is the perfect revelation of God. The Jesus of the Gospels taught forgiveness and turning the other cheek. Therefore, the nonviolence of Jesus kind of updates our understanding of the God of the Old Testament. And we've heard this in popular thinking. You've probably heard it said at different places, even on the television. The God of the Old Testament is a God of wrath and judgment, but the God of the New Testament is a God of love and forgiveness. And this is part of a heresy that started back in 200. A guy named Marcion. It was one part of his teachings that said that the God of the Old Testament is not the same as the God of the New Testament. But this is just not true. Read the book of Revelation. We see the wrath of God poured out in the Old and the New Testament, and we see the love of God poured out in the Old and the New Testament. What's interesting to me in the book of Revelation is Jesus himself is shown to be a mighty warrior who defeats and battles the armies of the earth. In the Revelation, the so-called nonviolent Jesus engages in some significant violence. And the difference, it's not hard to understand. Think about it for a moment. In the first coming, Jesus came as the Lamb to sacrifice himself for the sin of mankind. As he told Pilate, his kingdom is not of this world, and it was not to be established at that time. Therefore, one of the logical conclusions of that is we do not seek to build Christianity by military conquest or physical coercion. The Great Commission calls people to repent through persuading them, not threatening them. And so the followers of Jesus are to imitate his meekness and his gentleness. We do not return evil for evil. So that when one strikes you unjustly, you do not retaliate, but let him strike you again. When one sues you wrongfully and wins your coat, give him your shirt also. And we can act like that because the kingdom of our King is not an earthly kingdom. It is not of this present world. Our hope and our peace is not found in the possession of physical things. It is not found in the ability, in our ability to orchestrate and to work in the affairs of our government or to sway laws and things the way we want them to. Our hope is not found in this present world. However, at his second coming, Jesus will return as the rightful king who will subdue all of his subjects. He will subdue the rebels. His violence will not be a giant celestial temper tantrum. Rather, he will be returning as the righteous judge, executing judgment on the lawless. And that brings us to Psalm 35. Because this psalm is one of several that are known as imprecatory psalms. You see that, just to look at one verse, he says in verse 4, "Let them be confounded and put to shame that seek after my soul. Let them be turned back and brought to confusion that devise my hurt." He's asking for bad things to happen to bad people. That's why we call it an imprecatory psalm. An imprecation is a curse. Not in a voodoo sense of the word, I'm casting a curse on you with my prayers, or I'm saying some magic formula that's going to cause you to become sick. It's not that idea of a curse, but instead it is asking God to bring suffering and hardship upon a person. In a sense, it is the opposite of intercession. Intercession is going before God and asking God to bless another, to do good on another's behalf. Imprecation is going before God to ask Him to punish another. You can see why I say this is a bit of a challenging psalm this morning. Some of you might be wondering, do we even do this? Or is this just all, Old Testament? It's all David and it's a whole different dispensation. We don't even go there. I mean, doesn't this go against everything the Bible teaches us about how to pray for others? And possibly, the most common answer to this dilemma, at least the most common one I've seen, is one I've already hinted at. Many respond, this psalm is Old Testament. We are living under the New Testament, and God is dealing differently with men today. In fact, I read one commentator who's just said it very plainly, that this psalm does not at all apply to Christians today. So as we read it, kind of disregard this whole first part of the psalm. He said very specifically that to speak curses against any man is contrary to the Spirit of Christ. However, I would challenge that with three words. Matthew 23. If you're familiar with the Gospel of Matthew, if you're not, I challenge you to go read Matthew 23. In Matthew 23, 8 times, Jesus says, "Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees." He is pronouncing upon them grief and sorrow. He tells them they are going to receive the greater condemnation. They are going to suffer the damnation of hell, in fact. Twice in the epistles, there's a pronunciation of cursing. The King James uses the word anathema. But it's pronouncing a curse. Let him be accursed who preaches a false gospel, who does not love the Lord. In the book of Jude, it has this very, very strong words against the false prophets, against false teachers. It calls them all kinds of names. And it says, woe unto them. So clearly, speaking words of judgment against another is not entirely contrary to the New Testament. Now, I do recognize, and some of you probably already picking this up, the use of cursing in the New Testament is not exactly the same as that found in the Old Testament. Because the church is not Israel. Some of the things I've already talked about. Christ's kingdom is not right now. It's coming. And so we recognize that there are different kinds of curses, but these things are similar enough that we can and we must learn from this passage how to respond to those who wrong us. Because there is also more here than imprecations. There's more than curses against David's enemies. And I know that's a little bit longer introduction than I normally do, but I think all of that background is necessary. So I want to make, in a time remaining, I want to make 4 brief observations from this psalm to help us understand how do we respond when someone seeks our harm. And I do want to put it, define it a little bit narrowly in this sense. It's not how do I respond when somebody annoys me. Rather, and I think very specifically in the sense, in the context of Psalm 35, David is talking about those who are seeking to do him harm. Malicious abusers, destructive, those who are bent on injury of some sort. That seems to be the context here. So first and foremost, David is pleading to God for justice. He is not plotting revenge. That is huge in our understanding of what's going on. If we're going to even begin to understand this rightly, David is not here laying out his plans to get even with the evil men. He's not praying for justice while planning an ambush. Now, I know many things we ought to pray and to work to accomplish our prayers. We pray for souls to be saved, and we must be diligent in giving the gospel. In judgment, we must do the opposite. We must simply pray, but do nothing on our behalf. David knows that vengeance is of the Lord. He knows God has said, I will repay. So he goes, the very first verse he says, Lord, plead my cause. You stand up on my behalf. You intervene for me. It's not David saying, I'm going to get them, but it's David saying, God, I'm stepping back. You deal with them. And as soon as anyone decides he's going to get justice for himself, you can be certain it's not justice, but revenge. And as Christians, we must let the matters of justice and judgment rest in the hands of God. Now, I know there are lawful things that we can and ought do at times, but generally speaking, what I'm talking about is we're not looking for revenge. The other key element here is this is justice he is seeking. We're not talking about those who annoy. These are ones who sought David's destruction. They plotted against his life. Let me look at verse 7. He says, without cause they have hid for me their net in a pit, which without cause they have digged for my soul. You know, so they're not just trying to bother David a little bit and kind of get under his skin. Well, they have dug this big pit, threw a net in it to capture him and to seek his destruction. So David is serious here. They're plotting his life. And in doing so, in the context of the Psalms, they are violating a number of commands of God. Obvious ones, do not kill. They are violating the command to love one another. And again, in the context of Israel, they are scheming against the one that God had anointed to be the right, proper king of Israel. So that in doing this, in plotting against David, they are plotting against God himself. There is a much in this psalm in which what happens to David is a reflection of God and their response to or their view of God. So David is seeking divine protection from the attacks of the lawless. And I would say, and even though I would definitely say that it is right at times to pray for justice, and we pray for the judgment of the wicked even, we must still do so in accordance with the biblical commands of prayer. So that if we look at this, we pray for justice in accord with God's will. Not contrary to His will, but in accordance with it. Seeking His will, seeking the promotion of His kingdom, not doing so selfishly for our own personal satisfaction. So that, and I'm driving down the road doing exactly the speed limit, because I should, and somebody goes zipping past me, and then pulls up in front of me real fast and cuts me off and almost pushes me on the shoulder. And he annoys me. And I pray for justice. God, send a police officer to strike this man down with many tickets. At that point in time, I'm not seeking justice. I'm seeking a little bit of personal satisfaction. He got in my way. He cut me off. Maybe even did put me at risk. But I'm praying it from purely selfish reasons. And we must not. We must pray for divine justice, that God's name and God's glory be protected. Not merely that I will have the satisfaction of seeing him pulled over on the side of the road and getting fined or whatever's happening to him. The second thing I would say is, though David seeks justice, he does not delight in the suffering of another. Look at verses 13 and 14. He says, "But as for me, when they were sick, my clothing was sackcloth. I humbled my soul with fasting, and my prayer returned into mine own bosom. I behaved as though he had been my friend or brother. I bowed down heavily as one that mourneth for his mother." So he seeks justice. He asks for God to stop them, to cast them into the pit that they had dug. And at the same time, he mourns and grieves when they fall into suffering. How can that be? I mean, does that seem confusing? Maybe even some thinking, isn't that a little bit hypocritical? How can he, you know, say he's sorry for them when he prayed that they would for justice? I think we recognize there is an appropriate rejoicing in justice. We are glad when a murderer is captured and imprisoned. We are glad to see a tyrant overthrown. We know justice is good and right. There's a point where we can legitimately be happy when that happens. But at the same time, we should not delight in the suffering of anyone. You may remember when Saddam Hussein was hung. There was great joy in Iraq. And in Kuwait, in America, and other parts of the world. Some complained that he did not suffer enough. Others triumphed in the suffering and the shame that he did endure. And we look at it, and we look in that case and other similar cases, a genuine tyrant who did despicable things is executed. Seems to be, as far as I know anyway, executed in full justice. And we can say that was necessary and even good. And at the same time, say, I do not delight in the suffering that that man endured. We do not seek to make his suffering worse. And that's David's desire for justice here. Does not mean that he enjoys their pain, but rather when they suffer, he responds with sympathy. He sorrows along with them.
Point to God. Think of God, as he says, I think it's in the book of Isaiah. "As I live, saith the Lord, I have no pleasure in the death of the wicked, but that they turn from their wicked way and live." God executes judgment. In fact, we see again in the book of Revelation, we see believers praising God for his judgment that he executes. And God is rightfully praised there, and yet at the same time he says, "I don't delight in their death. I don't delight in their suffering and their destruction." And if we're going to look at these things, we understand, how do I deal with wicked people when they do wicked things against me? We can certainly plead to God for justice. But that does not mean that we begin to take a malicious delight in when bad circumstances happen, when they begin to sorrow and suffer.
And then third thing, David actively did good to those who did evil to him. Think about that for a second. David actively did good to those who did evil against him. They did treated David with great harshness. It says they lied against him. They were false witnesses that raised up and they laid to his charge things that just weren't true. Verse 12, they rewarded me evil for good to the destruction of my soul. King Saul was comforted by David. Israel's enemies were driven out before David. He was a mighty military leader that brought much success to Saul. And David even played his harp for Saul to soothe the king when he was in his fits of madness. Yet Saul responded to David's goodness with jealousy and anger and malice. He became so enraged in a couple occasions that he picked up a javelin and threw it at David to kill him. So enraged that David eventually had to flee for his life, spent years hiding in a wilderness. And when David was afflicted, none of his enemies comforted him. They rejoiced. They joined together. It seems like they had this great big feasting. And David is really the centerpiece of the feast. They are there to mock him, to rejoice in the suffering that he's enduring. Yet David did none of those things. He returned to them good. Though they replied to his good with evil, he replied to their evil with good. And the principle is really simple to state. Do good to those who mistreat you. It's very difficult to apply when someone is mistreating you. Turn to Romans chapter 12. I want you to see this passage. Romans chapter 12. We're going to look in verse 14. I want to just point out a couple things very, very briefly. What does God command us to do? He gives us in this section here a number of commands directly related to how we relate to those who do evil. So he says in verse 14, bless them which persecute you. Bless and curse not. Wait, isn't that a contradiction with what we've just been reading? I think the difference in Romans 12 is Paul is talking about our relationships towards others. How I respond towards them. So I do not call them evil names. I do not swear at them and spew blasphemies at them while they're mistreating me. I do not tell them that I, want all of these horrible things to happen to them. Rather, like Christ, when a wicked man persecutes you, do not revile him. Rather, bless him. Seek his good. Again, like Christ, and think of, hang him up on the cross. And the first thing recorded for us when he is hung on the cross is, Father, forgive them. And that should be the model for us. We do not repay evil with more evil. Verse 17, recompense to no man evil for evil. When someone cusses at you, don't cuss back. When somebody hits you, don't hit back. Some of this is basic kindergarten stuff that we know, but we get deeper in our lives. When somebody gossips about you, don't gossip about them. When someone stabs you in the back, don't slander them to your friends. When you're sinned against, don't sin back. That's what he is saying. Don't repay evil for evil. When someone does evil to you, do not sin in response. As Christians, we know when you are sinned against by a fellow believer, you have two options. First, in love, you overlook it.
Certainly, that is a counsel of, and we find in Peter's, charity, love covers a multitude of sin. We forgive it and move on. If you cannot overlook it, if it's something of such a nature that it just, you know, eats at you, you must go to that person, and only that person, go privately and confront the sin. Those are only two righteous responses. It's where we started. Overlook it, or I privately confront it. And then if you know Matthew 18, you know there are further responses after the private confrontation, if they're necessary. When an unsaved person sins against you, I would still say your options are basically the same. Your option is to overlook it, or to try to work it out. In fact, he says here in verse 18, as much as lieth in you, live peaceably with all men. Do everything you can to be at peace. Try to work it out. Never respond sinfully to someone else's sin. Instead, respond with good. Verse 20, therefore, if thine enemy hunger, feed him. If he thirst, give him drink. If one sins against you, suffering, sorrow with him and for him, as David did. If he has need, provide for that need. Look for avenues to do good. Now, some have interpreted the last statement there in verse 20. For in so doing, thou shalt heap coals of fire on his head. Some have said that, you know, basically that's kind of the Christian way to get even. You do good to him, and boy, that's going to really bug him. You're so bother him and confuse him, it's going to drive him up the wall. You're going to make his life miserable. So it becomes kind of a pious revenge. I think you can see that really does not fit the context at all, Romans chapter 12. It's not what Paul is saying. Paul's not giving us a super secret means to get even. He's telling us how to do right when others wrong us. And by doing good to that person, verse 21, you will overcome his evil with good. Now, this does not mean that if somebody at work is saying horrible things about you, and you take them a plate of cookies, that they're automatically going to like you. Overcoming evil is not, and it will not, eliminate the people problems and the problem people in your life. Because if that were true, if that was how we defined overcoming evil, that the people problems go away, then you could overcome evil by, you know, with a coworker who scorns Christianity, by setting aside your faith and living like everyone else at work. If overcoming evil was about removing difficulties, then David could have overcome evil by killing Saul when he had the chance. Overcoming evil is not about just stopping the bad circumstances. Rather, overcoming evil is about, not at least in part, not succumbing to, not bowing down to evil. You do not let sin overthrow you and trip you into sinning in response. So that as Christians, we could never say, he hit me first, or she'd made me do it. We never can say that. We look at that and we say, I'm going to respond rightly. I'm going to let their sin be an opportunity for me to do what is right. And this is what David is doing in Psalm 35. Above all else, and what he is doing is he's looking at these evil men and wicked men that are looking for his life. And he is responding by running to God and laying out his need. Asking for God's judgment and protection and deliverance. He's running to God and saying, God, help me. And I would say again, first and foremost, when you are troubled by others, run to the Lord with those problems. That is the right response, always. Run to the Lord. And then the other response. Do not seek revenge. Seek their good. Look for ways to minister to them. Sorrow with them in their grief. Seek to bless them. Even if all you get in return is more trouble, more evil back, do good. Because, and this wraps right back around to running to God. God has good plans and good purposes, even in allowing evil people to do evil things to us. We can trust the good purposes of God, that these things are happening for our benefit. And I can respond to them with good and not evil, because it's not about them. And there's a point where it's not even about me. Certainly it's not about my pride and my feelings getting hurt. It is about what God is doing in my life for my good. And I can turn around and I can minister grace to that one, because I know God is working graciously in me.